It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. He comes to us from the UK. His name is Luke Dodson. And he's been working on some very interesting research that I think is very important. Ties into many things that are happening around the world. But his specific kind of inquiry is this ecological movement and how it's being influenced by some of these more kind of postmodern, pretty out there ideas. And he can talk more about that. He has a podcast called The Dodcast. I was on that. And one of the article's titles that I read, the article's title is Queering the Pitch, a response to the Land Workers Alliance's statement on trans land workers, and trans land workers is in quotes. And then another article he read is Android Wolves, Electric Sheep, play on Philip K. Dick, Eco-Modernism and the Rise of the Green Technocracy. So he talks about the green technocracy, but he can talk more about that. So Luke Dodson, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Excellent. So for people who may not have heard your name or your work, I know that your family background, we talked in the pre-show, you have kind of grown up in the ecological idea movements, maybe left wing. Can you talk about your background and kind of what led you up to write these particular articles about this green technocracy?
Yeah, so going right back to the beginning, you know, my parents are academics and had been involved in various sorts of activist campaigns from the 70s through the 80s and 90s and to some extent into the 2000s as well. So I was definitely exposed to a lot of fairly radical political ideas and movements. You know, I was being taken to climate change demos and Reclaim the Streets kind of demos in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s. And this radicalism also goes back into my sort of ancestry as well. As I was saying in our pre-show chat, that my great-grandfather was a writer called J.B. Priestley, who's very prominent left-wing campaigner, was involved in the Labour Party here in Britain, campaign for nuclear disarmament, but also was a fellow traveller to a lot of members of the Fabian Society that I'm sure many listeners of this show will be very familiar with, like Aldous and Julian Huxley and various characters like that. And this is, you know, an overlap I have with Jason Horsley. Our ancestors, our mutual ancestors, knew each other and were collaborating on the same sorts of campaigns. So
that I've done tons of shows with Jason Horsley. I'm at least five or six. So we've talked about all of his books. I've been on his podcast as well.
Yes, I've listened to a few of the episodes of The Liminalist, which you appeared on as well. So, yeah, that was how I got in touch with Jason originally, through finding his work and realizing we had these a number of very interesting connections.
Are you also in Yorkshire, or what part of the UK are you in?
Right now I'm in Devon, which is in the southwest. Gotcha. I'm from London originally. So JB moved down south, and his second wife, who was my step great grandmother, was a very, very wealthy, posh lady. So he was brought down to the southerly regions.
But he's from Yorkshire too, so that's the connection
exactly
between Horsley and you. So the north eastern part of the UK. Sorry.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was my own background. You know, I studied English literature at university, and have been, you know, peripherally involved in some environmental campaigns over the years. The most active involvement I had was with the anti-fracking campaign in 2016 or so, 2015-16, which was the year that the year I found Jason's work, and the whole world kind of shifted in many different ways, you know, various sorts of cracks and fissures started to appear in the culture. And through my involvement with the anti-fracking campaign, but also my involvement with the psychedelics research scene and community, I began to notice a particular tone that was creeping into the environmental movement, which was very much focused on top-down technological, technocratic intervention into human society, human biology, even going into the ecosystem itself. So that the rhetoric was focused on genetically altering ecosystems to deal with climate change, which was a complete surprise to me to see environmentalists talking about this, because just 15 years earlier, you know, there was a lot of resistance to genetically modified crops here in the UK. A lot of, you know, prominent campaigners got themselves arrested for pulling them up. And so this sort of sense of intervention into biological life really began to be quite vocal and noticeable.
And that's kind of, sorry to interrupt, but that's kind of a change, because the old ecological movement was to go back to the state of kind of a closer state of nature, not modify it, right? So that's kind of like, we got to save this land to, you know, its primeval state. So this new thing is like, hey, we're going to upgrade this to, with our technological skills, to what we think is the new idea. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. So upgrade is the right word, sort of nature 2.0, you could say. We, you know, we've got our technological ingenuity. And I was a bit alarmed by this. This was quite a sudden jolt. I mean, you'd always had a bit of that idea that technology would save us all, and that, you know, we could just sort of harness the weather and all that sort of thing. But from that, and in particular, the Joker 71's just mentioning the New Green Deal, and this was something that was coming up around then as well, with the rise of Extinction Rebellion. What happened was I saw this sort of eco-modernist stuff, and I kind of footnoted it. I just said that's something to pay attention to, but, you know, I'm focused on other things for now. When Extinction Rebellion started, and Greta Thunberg and all of these the climate campaigns, I started to look a bit deeper, and this was also around the time I was discovering the work of people like James Howard Kunstler and John Michael Greer, who were talking about the issues facing industrial civilization in quite a nuanced way.
And you've had both of them on your podcast, so people can check that out through your website, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes, thanks. So the Extinction Rebellion campaign really started to send off some alarm bells for me. And particularly the way that it affected so many friends of mine, some of whom have since disowned me over the fundamental differences of opinion that emerged in the 2020s. The rise of XR seemed to enrapture so many people. It brought a sense of panic, a sense of urgency. It was highly alarmist in the way that, you know, climate change campaigns back in the early 2000s weren't so alarmist. And in fact, the sorts of predictions that climate campaigners were making back in, say, 2001, most of them hadn't come to pass by 2018.
Can you just describe what Extinction Rebellion really was, what their ideas were, what their kind of, who founded it?
Yes. So XR, or Extinction Rebellion, XR is sort of the short form, is a really fascinating case study that got me back into writing and blogging and really researching this stuff properly, because it was a really, really fantastic sort of anchor on which to hold and sort of push into something else, because it was so, something about it was nagging me that something wasn't right. The researchers that I would recommend for looking a bit deeper into Extinction Rebellion would be a collective that calls itself UN Extinction or Unextinction, and they have a number of articles over at the News from Nowhere website. That's nowhere.news. That's the hyperlink. And they've got a fantastic series of articles called Astroturfing the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So definitely check those out. And they've done an exhaustive research into the background of Extinction Rebellion. From what I understand, it seems to me as though media from the margins. The really key player in Extinction Rebellion is Gail Bradbrook. And Gail Bradbrook had a background in lobbying for the Blair government, principally for the telecommunications industry, which is an interesting sort of connection that I'll kind of bookmark that. Gail Bradbrook got involved with some climate activists in London, one of whom I also knew from way back when. And they formulated Extinction Rebellion with the help of another chap called Roger Hallam, who's has been distanced from XR due to various controversies. Or at least on the surface, he's been distanced, but I suspect they're collaborating still behind the scenes. Gail Bradbrook is a very dubious character. I've encountered her at one of the psychedelic conferences that I used to attend back in the days when I was involved in that scene. I mean, for one thing, you know, aside from her various links to the telecommunications industry, she also has links to the military via an ex-husband, whose name escapes me right now, but her ex-husband...
Simon Bramwell?
Possibly, yes. I'd have to recheck.
Or Jeffrey Forshaw, one of those two.
Yeah, she had a former partner who was involved with was a member of the RAF. So there's a military connection there, which is interesting. But also the oil industry, which is there's a kind of an interesting little detail there, because the quote unquote charity that she's involved with, which is called Citizens Online, which is ostensibly about widening access to the internet for disabled people or something that sounds very innocuous like that, is seems to be have a rather wider remit, which with the rollout of 5G and the massive emphasis on telecommunications in the wake of all the COVID lockdowns, which, you know, pushing people indoors so that they have to spend more time on the internet. Citizens Online also has one of its board of directors is an executive of ExxonMobil. Interesting little connection there. Gail Bradbrook claims not to know who this man is. She was picked up on it on Facebook, and this was documented on the UN Extinction News from Nowhere series. She said, oh, I've never heard of this. Richard Coleman is the name. I've never heard of Richard Coleman. Could you remind me of why I should know him? And he's been a prominent senior director of Citizens Online during pretty much the whole time that she was involved with it, which is not like she was just an intern for 6 months. She was working at Citizens Online for a long time. So you have Gail Bradbrook. Another sort of broader source of context would be Corey Morningstar's Wrong Kind of Green website, which again many listeners will probably be aware of. Corey Morningstar did an excellent series called The Manufacturing of Greta Thunberg, which is about the corporate industrial governmental factions behind Greta Thunberg, this, you know, this 12-year-old girl who just happens to be sitting outside of a school to protest climate change, and then this rich financier stroke PR agent just walks past on that day and creates this massive social media viral campaign about it. And this was all around the same time. It seems to me that the timing of it is quite relevant to the election of Trump and the voting in the vote for Brexit, basically. That it seems to me that around 2016, there was some sort of fissure and a great deal of conflict erupted between different factions of the global elites, and there's various factions trying to stage a power grab. You had these populist insurgents within the system, kind of like seizing power and speaking to the ordinary people in ways that they found refreshing. I'm not a Trump supporter myself, but I can understand certainly why people would find him a refreshing alternative. And what happened is 2 years later, you know, this sort of the faction of the elites that were very much in prominence in the 1990s, who'd suffered a bit of a blow to their power, you know, the EU, you know, the Democrats losing and such like, they staged a bit of a power grab. So Extinction Rebellion, Greta Thunberg, all this stuff was the first sort of chapter of this retaliation of let's take the power back for us. The other aspect of it, I think, is a realization that various industrial economic factors were in play that would lead to a great deal of economic instability, and this would result in insurrection and populist movements rising up, just people saying, we don't have enough, we just want to live, give us what we want. And the Yellow Vest movement is an example of that, you know, just people, I'm sure there were, you know, hidden factions behind that as well. But it seemed to me that the Yellow Vest movement was predominantly just people kind of saying something's wrong. We can't afford to live. We need to kick back. And that this was around the same time as the Extinction Rebellion movements, which were basically saying, tax us more heavily and reduce our standard of living because climate change is going to kill everyone in 5 seconds. So you get this, you get a kind of multi-pronged attack on, people's quality of life in the form of these the push for plant-based diets and insect protein, and you know, basically taking people, making it more difficult for people to access good, wholesome, healthy animal protein, which I believe is I believe that there are perfectly sound ecological and organic ways of getting a decent healthy diet. I don't think we need to eat bugs. I don't believe that we need to,
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Eat fermented bacterial soy. You know, if people wish to be vegan themselves, that's absolutely fine with me. I have no issues with people's personal dietary choices, but I certainly don't believe that it should be forced on people. And I certainly don't believe that the misinformation that this is intrinsically a better diet for the environment. So Animal Rebellion is a sort of offshoot of Extinction Rebellion at the moment, which is their particular form of activism is they go to supermarkets and they pour out milk onto the floor, which is one of these incredibly divisive and flagrant displays of privilege, in my opinion, that, you know, a time when food prices are going up, you know, energy prices are going up, people are finding it harder to make ends meet and to just do the things that they need to do to, you know, get their kids to school, to feed their families, to do all those things, but to just profligately waste dairy because of some half-baked climate ideology is just so incredibly entitled. And I just to put my own personal sort of take on it, I just think it's a quite inappropriate.
And there's all those demonstrations are going on. Climate change, paint on the walls. There's all kinds of activists, just like you said, this milk pouring out. They're just all over the place now, at least on the media. So
yeah,
this whole notion of the echo, this kind of new version of the echo activist or echo culture jammer is very pronounced. Yeah, I think so.
Yes. Absolutely. And, you know, the paint thrown on Van Gogh's sunflowers.
Right.
This was something I was just reading on Greer's blog, actually. He pointed out that mass-minded people can't stand great art because great art elevates the consciousness. And it does seem that there's a certain, you know, opposition to a sense of beauty, harmony, you know, a sort of an opposition to a sense of the sacred and of cosmic order that a lot of these campaigns seem to promote, this sort of ugliness and despoiling and trashing and this sort of thing. So that's an interesting footnote.
No, it's interesting. I find that a lot in the kind of communistic worldview too, is this striving for kind of this fairness and equality. You can't have something outstanding. You have to cut off the uniqueness to ensure this kind of conformist ideology and behavior, I think. I think that's
precisely. Yeah. And you know that the Fabians like George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells back in the 20th century realized that the end point of communism was the same end point as consumer capitalism, that the big corporate sort of takeover ultimately ends up with a uniform society, a mechanized society, a soulless society, a society devoid of the sacred, of uniqueness, of all of the peculiarities and idiosyncrasies that go along with the created world as we see it. But all of those can be streamlined out, and we can have one size fits all for everything. So.
Once one corporatized solution. I mean, here in the States, we're not that much far out of that. There's still some uniqueness and individuality around, but I think that the real background right here now is really kind of a fascism. But with all this language that you point out kind of in your articles, this whole BIPOC, trans inclusivity, and I think it was really interesting, like, so you have this, we're in a completely unique kind of world right now where you have this weird language, but also kind of this totalism in political, economic life. Like, it's really moved, especially after this whole lockdown where all the money went to the top. It's even more pronounced. So it's very interesting that, like, in communism, the state has all the power, right? So. It's almost something like that,
absolutely. The sort of socializing of our vocabulary and everything that we're supposed to be focused on. So an organization like the Land Workers Alliance 15 years ago, whether you agreed with everything they said or not, they certainly probably, I don't think they'd be so focused on just identity politics, because it's like, land workers, most of them aren't trans, whatever trans means. Most likely they're just, ordinary people working on a farm, working as a forester or a tree surgeon or whatever it is. And I've worked with those people, most of them are pretty sort of the earth kind of, working class blue collar people. They don't understand this kinds of language. They don't have any need for it. It doesn't come from their world. In fact, I don't believe that anyone understands the kind of language that this trans ideology is promoting. I think that that's the point of it. That's one of the things that I tried to highlight in the article, is that if you refer to someone as non-binary, you're already making a statement that it's circular, and so it's effectively meaningless. What is a non-binary person? What does it mean to be non-binary?
Right.
Putting up a binary between binary and non-binary. So what's non-binary? And this drives the wedge between the language we speak and our embodied lived experience of reality. So we can't then formulate a coherent conception of what reality is, because we're speaking lies, Solzhenitsyn, Solzhenitsyn said about living in communist Russia that the imperative for people of faith living in communist Russia is to live not by lies, is to refuse to speak the lies that the regime was telling them to speak. And this was a way of keeping their dignity and their faith in the face of this tyrannical regime. And when I hear people speak in this language, they're non-binary and this is why we need to respect them and their pronouns and all this sort of stuff, is it's a lie. And I can't, in my own conscience, say these words because I don't believe that these people will benefit from it. I don't believe I'll benefit from it. I think that fundamentally we need to get back to we need to get back, first of all, the old way of speaking.
Right, like actual meaning of words in a dictionary that you can define like that.
Yeah.
I mean, something we're taught in elementary school, like what are your actual words mean? And you actually indicate in your article, even the people who use these words don't even know what they mean.
Yes.
They don't even know the definition of that.
Like, yes.
What is a trans person?
Yes.
Define that exactly. Because it could be, there could be 50 definitions of that.
Yes. Yes. And it always seems to come down to, if you proclaim that you're a trans person, then you're a trans person, just like the journal that the Land Workers Alliance promoted, which said, well, if you feel like you're a land worker, then you're a land worker. You know, it's like, well,
my favorite part of the article is that you claimed that you were BIPOC to get the benefit and they accepted it.
They did.
Accepted it.
Yes, they did.
I'm BIPOC. Right.
So exactly. They
don't even believe their own definitions. Just whatever you want. Yeah.
It's whatever you want. They didn't even question me about it. And, you know, if they did, I was going to sort of pull out because I'm half American. And like a lot of Americans, I have a little bit of ancestry from the native peoples of that continent. And so I was going to pull that out and say, well, actually, I have, you know, a lineage from the Cherokee, Catawba and Osage tribe. So here you go. But they didn't even ask me that. So, and, you know, just for the record, I don't claim to have any, you know, I don't have any connection with people from those tribes. So I don't, you know, I've read about their culture and I respect their cultures and find them interesting. But, you know, I don't want to be one of these sorts of pretendian types that sort of bigs up his aspect, because I think it's an insult to people who come from these cultures to have their cultures ransacked in this way. But you know, they would have accepted me doing that if I'd wanted to.
But this almost is a ransacking of that blue collar native land workers ideology that's not tainted with this language or these ideas. There's probably, I mean, what's the real population of, quote, whatever trans is, what's that population in the general population? 1%, 2%? This is like a minority thinking pushed upon a majority who it's not even in their mind. But this whole language, like you said, it's imposed to have some type of effect, right? Some form of change.
Exactly.
It's not used, this kind of broken down language is not used at random. It's foreign intent.
Yes. Right? Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you point out that this is.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
How many of these blue collar people really identify as trans? And indeed, you know, for that matter, how many members of indigenous tribes actually would understand this language or accept it? There was that recent film, Matt Walsh's What is a Woman, which has a particularly amusing segment where he's talking to some Maasai tribesmen in Kenya. And through an interpreter, he's trying to ask them, well, you know, can a man be a woman? And they go, no, that you can't have that. It's like, what about a non-binary person? And like this translator's trying to interpret this, and then these guys in the background are just falling about laughing. Like, I can't, I'm not going to make it. Like, this is too much for me. Right. So
the Maasai tribesmen and the land worker are similar. So these ideas are, like, I think you pointed out in your articles that these ideas are coming from some kind of urban generation or something, and they're trying to impose it upon everybody. It's really something else. So these trans ideas do not come from land workers, blue collar people, rural people at all. It's coming from somewhere else, or through them. And I think it was interesting too. You mentioned this formation. So Matthias Desmets or Desmet, I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Yes.
But this formation then becomes self-perpetuating. Some of these people, I know people, I'm in California. So I know people who think these ideas, they don't even know where they come from. They have been, like, a software got put in their brain, and now they're promoting it like a software virus, thinking that they're at the highest level of human virtue.
Yes.
It's really incredible. Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, there's sort of going back to the climate activists and that sort of thing, that I think that this has happened with the climate movement as well, that a lot of these actions, you know, my dad asked me, do you think that this, you know, this Van Gogh vandalism was directed from top down somewhere? And it could well have done, but it also could easily have been just that all they have to do is set the ball rolling and, you know, some naive young people who are suffering from just a spiritual malaise, I'd put it, a lack of meaning in their lives. You know, they are looking for a sense of hope, a sense of purpose, and they find something that resembles it in this climate movement, and they just roll with that. And the controllers or whatever can just go, oh well, that's brilliant, you know. Having said that, I also do think that there are orders from top down to not prevent this sort of thing. Because let's just imagine if some anti-lockdown protesters had done something, you know, something like this. First of all, you know, it wouldn't be on the front page news. They'd try and hush it up as quickly as they possibly could. If they couldn't hush it up, they would demonize, and, you know, they would send in the troops to sort of sort it out. But of course, anti-lockdown protesters wouldn't do something like that, because the anti-lockdown protesters were just saying, we just want the right to hang out with each other and hug each other like normal human beings. So you know, we don't feel the need to desecrate classic works of art for our cause. But yes,
no, it is remarkable. There's something going on. So this is like the Greta Thunberg formation. I don't know if they're psychotic, but it's some type of psychological operation that has these things. This is the new postmodern religion, I think. If you don't have Christianity or Buddhism or something, this new kind of climate change ideology is it. So it's interesting, like all these guys out on the streets and protesting. And I mean, we can get into the whole carbon issue, but the carbon cycle is a real thing. So this additional carbon, man-made anthropogenic climate change, is actually, when you really look at it, it's actually kind of funny. Do you believe, are you a client? I mean, I don't even use the word climate change. It's not, because climate change has always happened on Earth since its inception, or however the ball started spinning around the sun. But that's why, I mean, you can't, that's another element of language, the move of language into a term that really doesn't mean anything, kind of like conspiracy theorist, where the climate change has always changed. So are you against climate change? You're against reality. You're using a term that is like, you know, water boiled turns into steam or something. That's just what happens. Climate changes. The sun goes around, it goes down, it gets dark and cold, and then it gets hot again. I mean, just the fact that they're using that term is just going back to the language again.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Which, just like Orwell, they have to corrupt the language, right? Just to get people together.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for myself, I'm an agnostic. I don't know, basically. I don't know what's... I suspect that probably everything has some kind of impact on the climate, because, you know, everything, the climate's always changing anyway. So to single out, singling out carbon, whether carbon emissions are changing the climate or not, for me is like, that's another debate. I think that I'm happy for people to discuss that. And I kind of lean slightly skeptical to, I think that, I doubt it's changing the climate as much as is being claimed at the moment, but I'm open-minded. But for me, it's what I find really interesting is the way that if you focus on carbon, you focus on these isolated gases, you can basically stop talking about pollution, which is what the environmental movement was originally focused on. And you can actually come up with ways to offset your carbon footprint by funding a tree planting campaign over here, or putting up a carbon capture facility over there, or all of these sorts of various methods, some of which might work better than others. You know, planting trees, depending on where and what type, might, you know, at least can't hurt, probably. You know, other technologies just obviously actually don't work at all. Carbon capture and storage actually increases the carbon emissions. So, but it means that a company can sort of put this label on their product and say it's carbon neutral. It's carbon neutral, so it's environmentally friendly, so it's good. So it's all just, you know, it's all puff and drama and marketing and PR and, you know, so yeah.
Right. And but it's that whole strange language that people are having to absorb. And I think you talked about Dalrymple, where he's saying this language is trying to get you to suck into the system and give up, really. Right. And just go along and be kind of a NPC and, oh, sure, boss, whatever you want, whatever your pronouns are. I'm fully for trans rights, even though I cannot define what trans means. But it actually leads to real world events, because you mentioned a couple of characters. Somebody who I didn't know was this guy, Martine Rothblatt, and some other ones, Sophie Pritchard. They're actually wealthy people who are trying to institute these ideas or expand these ideas within the common culture, right?
Hmm. Yes.
Can you talk about them?
Yes. So Martine Rothblatt is a billionaire CEO of various sorts of, you know, Silicon Valley type tech companies. And she is a transgendered person.
She was a he until 40. Yeah.
Rothblatt has been quite open about transgenderism being a Trojan horse for transhumanism. That this is, or a gateway rather, not because it's once it's out in the open, you know, you're talking about it's not a Trojan horse anymore. It's just the first step. So the idea is that you get people to unmoor. The unmooring of gender identity from the physical body, you know, which Jennifer Billick has talked about that. And then, you know, from there, the next step is the unmooring of the human identity from the physical body. And then you can just start to alter and modify the physical body at will, so that, okay, my gender identity doesn't align with my physical body, so my gender identity isn't the thing that needs to be looked at, it's my physical body. So my physical body needs to be chopped and changed and rewired, and I need to take all drugs and sort of have these invasive surgeries that are irreversible and effectively will leave the body a eunuch, you know, leave the person a eunuch, because it doesn't match up to my gender identity. But then from there you can go in, and there are transhumanists who, for instance, believe that they'd be much happier in the body of a dragon, and they look forward to a future in which they can modify their own body to be a fire-breathing dragon flying around the skies. These, you know, these people genuinely feel like that's their true. Right.
But so for them, for a young kid to go through these gender surgeries and drugs, that's okay, because they believe that too. So whatever you feel, so this whole ideology is all there. So it's in this, like you write, this is a direct quote, it's an assault on naturalism, essentialism, vitalism. So those basic fundamentals that everybody took for granted for generations, in this generation, by those people, is an anachronism. It's really incredible. So for some of those people, and that guy, I keep an eye on that guy, whatever his name, Martin Rothblatt. He's talking about changing consciousness into a robot.
He
has started his religion. His son is a member of that religion. They're all non-binary. They have like pansexual views. Mm-hmm. It's Luciferianism. It's like really, and it's interesting because you mentioned Harry Hay. And I had a whole chapter on Harry Hay in my book, Children of the Beast, because a lot of people don't know he's the founder of the gay rights movement, but he came up with this two-spirit thing that you talked about.
Yeah.
But Harry Hay, at his start, he's a communist. He had communist views and used to play piano at the OTO lodge in Hollywood. Literally played piano at these early Crowley meeting. So and actually the gay rights movement there are little traces of this Crowleyan view, because Crowley had this non-binary view. They didn't have those terms back then, but he would be like a pansexual. I think Crowley would be seen as a pansexual.
Yes.
And his followers too. And you can talk about Genesis P. Orge and some of these other characters who are doing the same thing. Genesis P. Orge, Crowley follower. I think he cut his, I mean, he was really one of the first body modification, I guess you could call it, per people out there. So it is interesting how these are overlapping. And I would like to see, I don't know Rothblatt's religion, but I'd like to see how close it is to the kind of Crowleyan Thelemite stream. Be interesting. And it's incredible. So Hay, even I think in one of his later things, he's quoting Crowley, and I included that in my book. So.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I wasn't aware of that. It's really interesting, but not at all surprising, because as you say, Crowley had this kind of, you know, pansexual, kind of sexual liberation ethos of, you know, anything goes. You know, and you know, that's been hugely, hugely influential, hugely popular, and you know, we're starting to see the consequences of when you unleash that kind of ideology on a society at large, and you know, the sorts of things that are being taught to children nowadays. But you know, like. As so many people I know that back in, let's say, the 1990s would have been on the liberal end of the spectrum, just like, yeah, you know, yeah, we're tolerant and we don't have a, you know, we're fine, whatever. Like, you know, gay rights is no problem. And then so many people are actually now going, hang on a minute, there's something really going, something really odd going on here. And indeed, a lot of people within the gay community itself are also saying, hold on a minute, you know, this is, you know, gays against groomers who've had their social media platforms sort of compromised and such, like PayPal, I think. And, you know, they, you know, they're allowing, this is the same platforms are allowing openly paedophile advocacy groups to retain their accounts, but Gays Against Groomers, which seems to me like a perfectly wholesome, you know, campaign, you know, group of people in the lesbian and gay community, bisexual community, whatever, saying, well, actually, we don't really want this agenda being pushed on children because it's not appropriate. And they're the bigots.
Right. Ah, strange days. I mean, very strange. Like, there's all, I mean, there's all kinds of like pedophilia stuff on Twitter, is my understanding, that they don't even get rid of it. And it's really crazy. It's just a crazy, crazy world. And it's interesting how you talk about how the land workers, like, they're much more concerned about this whole terminology and trans rights than the actual global assault upon land rights in the world, right? So we've seen Sri Lanka ongoing in the Netherlands, Australia, just everywhere. There's a total WEF assault upon these blue collar people doing their jobs, and they're overlooking it for this kind of woke ideology. It's really astonishing. Yeah.
Yes, it really is. You're absolutely right that they are completely overlooking, you know, one of the most important kind of land workers movements of today. And you know, another statement that the LWA issued was a statement in support of migrant land workers, which I think is really interesting, because to be a land worker means to have some sort of connection and relationship to the land that one is working, and to really have a stable society of land workers, there needs to be some continuity there. But that continuity is not really compatible with a globalized world. And so that's why I think there is this huge focus on refugees and migrants from these sorts of organizations, which is that, you know, if you dilute a population with, you know, all kinds of different nationalities, and, you know, that's it gets into some thorny territory, but essentially, you know, you are gonna destabilize that society and mean that everyone becomes rootless, and the migrants themselves are also rootless. You know, they've been uprooted, or they've uprooted themselves, but, you know, that in many cases these are people fleeing issues that the very same elites have created, that they are now expecting the host populations to make room and make way for people running away from the wars and the, you know, the terrible situations that they started in the first place, with their wars in Iraq and their wars in Syria and all of these things that, and, you know, that to sort of to focus on that, I think, is a really interesting and revealing aspect of what the LWA are really about.
Right. It is interesting. I mean, they say that if you want to destabilize or take over a country, that's what you do. Bring in foreign populations and destroy the kind of coherence or cohesiveness of the group that's presently there. So that's really what's happening all over the world, US, Europe. I don't know if it's not happening anywhere, really. They're moving. It's happening in the first world, I would say.
Yeah.
Except for really Japan doesn't seem to really have that view that they really want to take in people or refugees. They don't seem to have the refugee problem. Yeah, but in other parts of the world, U.S. and Europe, definitely happening. And the consequences are going to be immense over the next 50, 100 years, too. Especially when you bring in refugees to a place that's hurting, like the collapse is going to happen within the next 5 years. It's collapsing now. Imagine what happens with these refugees in a collapsed economy.
Oh, yeah.
It's just going to, I mean, here in California, something that I've never seen is now almost every store has security because there's people here who came here either illegally or illegal immigrants, and they're just stealing stuff out of these stores left and right. There's like people getting busted for shoplifting all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that I've never seen. I mean, they're desperate, right? So they need to eat, but...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's not a functioning society when you're letting people in who can't function in the society without crime. It's incredible.
No,
it's a whole other story.
Particularly good for it's not particularly good for the migrants themselves, because there will be many migrants who are attempting quite earnestly to get to a country, to live there, live a wholesome life, productive life, and integrate with the community. But they're not going to be helped by an open door policy that's allowing, you know, a bunch of vagabonds, criminals, and terrorists to join them in that sort of march. And the idea that you can just bring in vast numbers of fighting age men from war-torn countries into stable liberal, well, previously stable liberal democracies, and not have some kind of massive blowback that will end up having ramifications for the elites themselves who are staging it. This is the thing I find particularly ironic and tragic, is that this has happened before. And in fact, in my own country, you only have to look at the history of the fall of the Roman Empire here, and how the Anglo-Saxons, the ancestors of them, were originally invited in by the Romans and the post-Roman aristocracy as mercenaries. And then more of them came, and then more of them came, and then more of them came. And as a result, now we're speaking English. You know, the ancestor of the tongue that we're speaking was brought here by migrants, which I think is really funny, because liberals really like to point out the waves of migration of history as being like, well, this is an example of why it's absolutely nothing to worry about and perfectly natural. But you're ignoring all of the bloodshed, the heartache, the trauma, the uprooting, the languages and cultures and ways of life that were eclipsed from one, you know, successive wave to another, that now, you know, archaeologically, we're seeing that there was actually that there were these, you know, quite drastic upheavals of popular, not necessarily complete genocide or anything, but certainly, you know, it's. I think people can't really handle or face up to the gravity of the situation that we're facing with the migration. It's taken me a while to come to a point where I could be open about it and accept it, because, you know, I don't have a particular issue with being around people of other nationalities. I find them fascinating. I went to university with many people from all over the world, and I really enjoy talking to people from other cultures and listening to their particular take on reality. But you know, the writing's on the wall.
I don't know, man. How many people can you fit in the boat? I don't know. Yeah. Here in the States, you can't fit as many, because here in California, you have 50,000 people living on the streets, like, and then you're bringing in a new population. It doesn't make any sense. It's crazy. Yeah. I don't even know what the political class here is even thinking. I think that they're in a bubble. They're in gated communities, very wealthy. So that just to them, Everybody outside of that's just a big horde of like unwashed, useless eaters, so they don't really even care. That's my opinion. But I mean, I think that, yeah, I think that we're in a crazy environment. But I think that this land use and everything like that really does have to do with migration and the farming and all that stuff, and how what they haven't planned for us too is really that you're not going to get a healthy diet. They don't want you to have a healthy diet, plant-based diet. They, you know, some of these animals are good for the ecosystem, right? Because they're, you know, eating stuff. There's manure. There's all kinds of advantageous things about this kind of the cyclical use of the land and things like that. And it's like, they're going to make you eat bugs. Like, what did you write here? You get George Monbiot's fermented bacterial feces, Bill Gates's lab-grown pseudo meat, or Klaus Schwab's ground-up insect chow. It's crazy. It's so crazy.
Yeah, those are the three choices that will be on offer for the peasants of the Great Reach. Well, the elites will be eating steak and, you know, caviar and all the rest of it.
Organic, everything organic. So they'll have all organic food, no pesticides, grown locally, but you're going to get slop. I guess the Great Reset is trying to reset back to the old feudal state. I think that's really it. So they're going to sit in Switzerland and all the other slobs. They'll just treat like crap and give garbage food and garbage ideas, really. Mm. These old garbage ideas of trans, whatever, or anything.
I mean, I'd say that in fact that their resetting is actually potentially to a level of, for the ordinary person, a level that's actually below that of a medieval peasant. That a lot of medieval peasants actually were able to get a bit of animal protein, maybe once every week or so. Well, meat once every week, probably eggs and milk and things more often than that. And so actually, we may end up being in a worse off state than the average medieval peasant. The medieval peasants might be looking at us, you know, from the afterlife going, oh, damn.
Yeah, you had it bad. I guess the peasants were never in debt like they are here in the States. Like, everybody's in debt. 40 or 50% of Americans cannot handle a $500 bill. So I don't know how free you are, how much you're not a peasant. I guess you have to hit people with propaganda to make them feel like you're free or whatever. But if you're not much different than a indentured servant, if you own money on your mortgage, and then how they've inflated everything, so your mortgage is going up. Yeah. A lot of these, they're going to just kick all these people out of their houses again, just like they did back in 2008.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Oh, man, yeah, it's bad. This is, I mean, we're run by just, I mean, at least in the States, our political classes just does not. It's literally let them, Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. F the poor here in the States. So it's terrible. They don't care.
Yeah.
But especially when they're shipping $100 billion off to a useless war that doesn't affect really anybody here. They just have to propagandize people into thinking it's worthwhile when it cares. I don't care. They're literally supporting Nazis in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Like the whole far right. I mean, it's not funny. It's like a dystopian hellscape, but like, you're literally sending money so these people, Nazis, can get trained. You're so stupid. It's just unbelievable. I'm not saying you, I'm saying the American people.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is that in here in Europe, I mean, we are directly affected by it in the sense that, you know, we did get our gas predominantly from Russia. And then what's happening now is that, you know, the Nord Stream pipeline explosion, who knows what was going on there.
US did it. The US did it.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
nobody wants to say it now.
Yeah, it's you know, that now that we're being asked to support a war that is actually compromising the ordinary people's livelihood, and then to go back to the climate activists, what I found particularly amusing was Just Stop Oil pair that, you know, threw soup on the Van Gogh painting, claimed to be protesting both fossil fuels and increased energy costs. And I've just been writing a piece on this, and I realized that basically what they're doing is equivalent to saying, we're protesting against whaling and the increased costs of whale meat. That's the same kinds of, you know, that's the logic there. You know,
because
they think that solar power and wind power is going to reduce energy costs. Well, take a look at Germany for a case study in how that won't work, you know. But there we go.
I mean, it's really amazing. And these weird kind of NPC icons on the back of their shirt, like, I don't know what they're trying to impart with that. Do you know what the symbol is? Do you know what it references?
I have no idea. It looks like a light bulb, a cross between a light bulb and one of the Borg from Star Trek, but with a kind of got an NPC vibe, as you point out.
Yeah,
and a sort of kind of like a skull, but everything's very sort of morbid, and it's very much a death cult, this climate cult. You know, it's seems to be really speak to a sense of nihilism and despair that I think is very sad. That particularly the idea that, you know, it's not worth having children because, you know, the future is so terrible. I find it all very very sort of defeatist and nihilistic.
I agree. Sky is falling. We're right at the cusp of the end of the stuff. All you have to do is go back and watch Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth and just go, there's something wrong here because all his predictions are all wrong. And then you have to kind of go, well, why are they wrong? Luke, we're at 60 minutes. Do you have a few minutes to take a couple questions?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to.
Joker asks, what are your thoughts on Jeremy Hunt and Liz Truss and the budget issues?
This is something I have to say. I've been only peripherally observing the clown show that is the British government at the moment. I am aware that Liz Truss has been booed out of the press conference she gave, where she was asked to apologise. Jeremy Hunt seems to be in a position to sort of take over, but it's just something I haven't really been paying much attention to, because the British government seems to be completely chronically incapable of doing anything worthwhile or making any sense. So I just sort of I dip my head in here and there. So I have to mostly plead ignorance on that, I'm afraid.
Yorkshire Rose asks, does Luke have any answers to thwart this?
I would say grow vegetables in your garden if you can. Work on insulating your house. You know, think about that. Think about ways you can save money and save costs. Think about skills that you might have that are tradable or commodities. And make good connections with your community. You know, love your family, love your friends, be there for them when they need you. Choose people who are going to be there for you as well. Thwart this by filling your own world with everything that is wholesome and right and good and stable and strong. You know, stand with your own conviction, stand with your own faith, whatever faith that may be, and thwart it through bringing the truth and bringing the light of wholesome living into the world, and that ultimately these plans will fail, and ultimately that, you know, this empire is based on lies and it will fall apart. And I do believe that this is a fantastic opportunity to stay true to what is real for you.
Good answer. And so John asked, does Luke have any thoughts on Samuel T. Coleridge's Ancient Mariner? Was he a sort of pre-ecologist nature conservationist? Do
you know anything about that? Interesting question. I would say that the Romantic poets in general were precursors to this sort of awareness generally. You know, I'm also thinking of William Wordsworth, but also William Blake, and many poets coming out of the Romantic movement, who were essentially responding to the rise in industrial society. They were aware that something really radical and huge was happening in the world.
Right. And Blake called them the Satanic Mills, right? Like, I mean, exactly. They saw them very sinister looking. Yeah.
Yes. And you know, his picture of Newton, sort of Newton bending over the rock and just observing his diagrams. So I do think that there's a real case to be made that the and I think if many of these Romantic poets were alive today, they'd be aghast and horrified by the kind of the plans enacted by the WEF, and also would be horrified for one thing by the idea of desecrating a fabulous piece of art. That would be completely incomprehensible to them. Why would you do that? Why would you take a masterpiece and you know, throw soup over it? That would be quite
it's kind of like a strange symbolism. I don't think they even got it, but like Campbell's is the perfect example of mass produced canned reality. That's what they're throwing on this masterpiece of the opposite of that, a guy who lived in poverty and derision and struggle and anonymity, creating world-class art. I mean, it's really something else.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, also that the tin of soup as being an example of the kind of like sort of mass-produced bland pop art of the 20th century because of Warhol's Campbell's. You know, it's like, why not throw a tin of soup over Warhol's Campbell's soup? I mean, at least that would be kind of funny. Like, at least that would be kind of an amusing, like, yeah, all right. But no, they have to take... So I thought that would be ironic, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Oswald Spengler asks, has Luke discovered any direct connections between those early German Green Movement pedo advocates and these echo queers he's crossed paths with?
No direct connections, but there is... There is a symmetry there, and they're definitely in the future everyone will be able to desecrate art for 15 minutes. I think there is definitely an overlap in ideology and a fundamental a particular form of progressivism that you take. I mean, you know, we've got Oswald Spengler has joined us in the chat, so great honor to have Mr. Spengler.
Resurrected
idea about Faustian civilization. Faustian civilization just seems to take everything to the extreme. So the idea, you get an idea of progress, and you just take it to its absolute. You just keep going and keep going, and you erase all boundaries. And I saw a tote bag worn by a young sort of art student-y type woman in Canterbury in the UK once, which was a big student town. And it said, no borders, no binaries. And that was the slogan. And I thought that this was just such a revealing statement. Of no borders and no binaries. I wanted to ask her actually if she used a computer, because of course if you don't have binaries then you can't really use computer technology, which is based on binary code. So might be a bit non-binary code.
Yeah, ones and zeros, that's it, that's the foundation. That was what was the guy who did the Enigma, what was his name, that was really his gift to mathematics and computers, was he said all decision making can be distilled down to a one and a zero.
Yeah, Turing. Is it Turing?
Turing, yeah, Alan.
Yeah.
I spoke to his, I think it was his nephew, Dermot Turing. He wrote a book about him, XYZ. Really good. Interesting. You can go back. I'll should put it in the show notes. Maybe you can listen to it. I find it pretty interesting. Alan Turing was amazing. Guy was a full genius. Is there anything you'd like to add or anything I missed, Luke? I mean, where can, why don't you tell people where people can read your stuff, social media, how they can contact you, etc.
Sure. Well, I have a Substack account, which is I migrated from my previous website to Substack recently and shifted all the stuff over there. So that's flintandsteel.substack.com. So that's where I'm going to be putting up everything from now on. You can find my whole archives there. I'm on Twitter and YouTube and those sorts of platforms, but I'm trying to kind of step back from those mainstream media outlets and really focus on something a little bit more direct. But you can find me on those. You can find all my podcasts on YouTube and also on Rumble as well. That I'm backing everything up on Rumble. Which is a much better platform than YouTube, who've already removed two of my videos. So I suspect that my days on YouTube are numbered anyway. So Substack's the main place. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Rumble. And feel free to reach out. I like to have direct interactions with people who you know, read my work and listen to my podcast. I like to have a direct connection. So, you know, anyone who's interested, please don't be a stranger. Please do reach out.
Yeah, I see you're interested in Burroughs. And this is what, where Eros Cannot Go, the fragmented metaphysics of William Burroughs. I did a show about him. What's your kind of, what's your take on Burroughs?
Burroughs was, I think, essentially a victim of the world that produced him. I think he was a victim of an elite culture, a cultural elite, and you know, his family history was connected to Ivy Lee. His uncle was Ivy Lee, the founder of one of the founders of public relations, along with Edward Bernays and
Rockefeller. He represented the Rockefellers. Yeah.
Yes, exactly, and the Nazis as well. Has some contact with Nazis. So, you know, very dubious character. And Burroughs himself, I think he was a victim of abuse, and he recapitulated that abuse in his own life. And his life was very sad and very full of tragedy and chaos, and, you know, shot his wife. You know, his son committed suicide because of essentially being neglected by Burroughs and abused by Burroughs' pederastic friends. And so I think Burroughs' writing is very, is a mixed bag between very interesting, sometimes very entertaining, so often absolutely disgusting, but really reflects the complexities of his own character, who is a tormented man, really trying to work with his trauma in all the wrong ways.
Right, more drugs, crazy. Luke, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for sharing all your knowledge about this kind of echo movement and its infiltration. I think everything's just going to be infiltrated, right? I think that just our own autonomy is next, I guess, is the next thing. But really great piece, great references, well-researched. No names are in there, Horsley, Dalrymple. And things I learned, I didn't know that character's name. I didn't know who Martine Rothblatt was, or this other woman, Sophie Pritchard and Tiger. So I learned a lot just reading that one article. So thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on, and really enjoyed the chat, and I hope to speak again sometime.
Yeah, likewise. Good. All right, cool. Have a great one. Stay there.
See you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.